Sykes, Judge Posner, and Judge Dowd. This case presents, again, speaking of foreign maritime statutes, it asks the court to interpret the interplay of the American Maritime and Admiralty Rule G7, which would allow for an interlocutory sale of perishable goods that have been seized by the government in order to preserve the value of that, and how that's to be read and harmonized with the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act of 2000, or as I referred to it this morning, the CAFRA, and the government's burden of proof thereunder.
Before you get too far,
yes, Your Honor. Austin,
do we have a live controversy here? Has the expiration date on all of this formula passed already?
Yeah, we have a live controversy. There is approximately, and you have the advantage or disadvantage of having both trial counsel, Mr. Campbell and I, who have litigated this, probably about 15% to 20% of it remains viable. It will, by the end of the summer, end of the year 2009, probably be entirely expired and unsaleable.
Thank you.
The initial concern that the court, the government, has argued about and the court has is, does jurisdiction lie? I think there is a justiciable controversy, as Judge Sykes asked about, and I appreciate that. And we applied originally under 28 U.S.C. 1292 for a certification of the issue from Judge Adelman at the district court, a jurist I've known for many years, both before he was on the bench and now. He declined to issue that, agreeing with the government's position, and then we sought under the Cohen Collateral Order Doctrine and 28 U.S.C. 1291 this appeal. And Cohen, as it's been interpreted in Barron's and the Ho-Chunk Nation case of this circuit, permits an appeal from a non-final order when deferring the appeal could inflict irreparable harm to the party, and if the order conclusively determines an important issue collateral to the merits, that issue being, what burden of proof, if any, does the government have in a pre-forfeiture trial but in a seizure situation? And prior to...
Well, you have the burden of proof because you're seeking the interlocutory sale.
Yes, sir. And we sought initially a what they call a hardship release under CAFRA 983 sub F. Court denied that, and then during the discussion and argument, the issue of the applicability of G7, which applies specifically to perishable goods, came up. And we re-asked the court again for an interlocutory sale, joined by Wells Fargo, which was the lender for my client and who was the secured creditor, and this 800
to... I don't understand the burden of proof issue. You ask, any time you ask for something, you have to prove, you know, the stuff is safe and can be sold.
And, Your Honor, we did. The government...
So why are you arguing about burden of proof?
Because, Your Honor, prior to CAFRA, and this is the critical issue that brings us before you, there, the res or the seized property was presumed guilty unless the party could show...
What about presumptions? That were you able... Is it your view that you proved that this is safe?
Yes,
Your
Honor.
So is that the issue we should decide whether you... whether Judge Adelman was wrong to think you hadn't proved that or what?
Both, Your Honor, whether the government did not have to prove anything in a positive sense. The government brought in witnesses who hadn't examined or tested. They had viewed
basically
some of the cameras.
So is that the issue, whether there's adequate evidence to justify the judge's order?
That's, I think, Your Honor, the chief focus of our argument here.
The problem with the issue as you framed it on burden of proof, hasn't the judge already said it doesn't matter to me? So if the Court of Appeals says the burden of proof's on the government, he'll say, well, I already told you, even if the government burden is on the government. So isn't Judge Posner's question is, you really want review of the merits decision, not the burden of proof decision, right?
Merits first, but burden of proof. We would argue, as I did in our brief, Your Honor, that had the government decided the government bears, or had Judge Adelman decided the government bears some burden, that is by a preponderance, it would have required, and I think the district court would have demanded at least some kind of testing of even one of the 80,000 cans to show that there is some kind of taint or
proof problem. Proof is only important if there's a tie. Unless you're going to argue, you know, reasonable doubt, which you're not, right?
No, we're not arguing reasonable doubt.
Well, Judge Adelman didn't think it was a tie. So why would burden of proof matter?
Because, Your Honor, the record before was basically an absence of proof. It was conjecture and surmise.
Yes, that has nothing to do with burden of proof. You're saying he's wrong. There isn't enough evidence of the evidence shows that this is safe, not dangerous. Isn't that what you're saying?
Well, the government argues it's dangerous. It may be dangerous, but doesn't present one test, one expert who's actually examined it and shown a scientific test. Yes, it's tainted. Not one can. And this is a case that began not as a food safety case, but began with an allegation and a seizure that the 80,000-some cans were supposedly stolen rather than obtained in the course of purchases in the secondary food distribution market. It then changed after we filed our motion and petition for a hardship release into a forfeiture action, and then the food safety issue came up. But again, not a scintilla of positive evidence that any one of these cans is tainted. There's argument to that effect by the government's witnesses, but we asked from the beginning and over the past year and a half, let's test some cans, as I pointed out in our brief.
How about the mislabeled can? Wasn't there a mislabeled can in testimony that if someone who had an adverse reaction to that, if they bought the can under the wrong label, that they could be badly injured?
Judge Dowd, that is correct. The government mentioned there was one mislabeled out of 80-some thousand. The cans themselves, and I was going to bring one in, but I thought security would
pose someone look at all 80, you say one out of 80,000? Someone looked at all 80,000 cans?
No, sir.
Well, how do you know it's only one?
The government looked at and said at their hearings they've looked at 6,000 as a sample and found one.
Okay, one in 6,000, then maybe 6 into 80, you know, it's 13, so maybe there are 13 of these cans, right?
We asked for that, and the answer was no. We asked,
well,
let's
do some
testing. What do
you mean you asked for that? If they only looked at 6,000, not at 80,000, if that's their sample and they found one can, then that implies, not proof or anything, but that would suggest if you looked at all 80,000, you'd find more, right? That's what sampling is.
It could, but sampling that would be verifiable and appropriate according to military standards of the government's wisdom, excuse me, Your Honor, would take at least about 300 to 500 cans, and that's what we asked for. The government's witness...
You say they looked at 6,000.
Right, but actually testing the cans, cutting them open, testing the powdered formula.
But they found one mislabel.
One mislabel.
And if they'd looked at all 80,000, they probably would have found like a dozen mislabeled.
Can't say they would, possibly, but no more. And I think the problem with this is...
Possibly.
Possibly, Your Honor.
It's called sampling.
A valid sample, according to the government's witness, would have been several hundred.
No, they looked at 6,000. That's a large sample.
Correct.
That's a large sample.
Okay.
It's more than 300.
Yeah, and that's looking at the exterior of the can and not testing its contents. And the government.
I understand, but they found a mislabeled can out of 6,000. If they looked at 80,000, they would probably have found more mislabeled cans.
And we asked for an inventory of all of them and an examination, rather than this Midas touch.
80,000 examined.
Sure.
And tested. You want 80,000 cans tested?
No, the government asked for that. We asked for a valid sample. We wanted a valid sample, about 300 to 500 tested. And also the ability to review the cans and look at to make sure are they labeled correctly. Does the label match the paper label on the outside? You have an embossed metal dating and indication of what the formula is.
So why didn't you test them?
We weren't allowed to. We were allowed access one time.
Do you want to test? You wanted to do the test in your or pay for it. Is that what you wanted?
We were willing to put up would cost about $10,000 to $15,000, but we were willing to do that. But the bank was interested in protecting the collateral, too, and we have been denied that access to it.
As I understand your legal argument, apart from the question of the factual sufficiency of the record here, the legal argument is really twofold. It's that the government had the burden of proof on the question of the propriety of the interlocutory sale, which was what everybody was in court about.
Right.
But because in this circumstance, an adverse decision to you operates as a de facto ultimate forfeiture on the merits, that the government should have the burden also of proving its merits forfeiture case at that juncture. Is that a fair statement?
That is, Your Honor.
Argument? Was it put exactly that way to Judge Adelman? Because as I read his decision, it really focuses on the first question about who's got the burden of proof on the propriety of the sale and not on the second legal argument.
Oh, it was clearly,
and the government has argued waiver. So.
Your Honor, excuse me, let me let you finish. It was clearly, I believe, put before Judge Edelman that if the court did not grant some kind of mechanism by which the property could have been orderly, subject to an orderly liquidation, and whatever monies were gained from that would be held in escrow or a bond, so the government would ultimately be able to have some value. And right now, it's been diminished. The village has been destroyed, I guess, to save it, to use an old analogy from a different era. And that acts as a grant informally of summary judgment for the government, because there's nothing left by the time, even if this court acts expeditiously, there'll be very little left, I should say. But I fear, and I see my time is up here.
So what is the market value of these 81,000 cans?
Originally, Your Honor, we felt it was between $850,000 and $1 million. Wholesale or retail, if you go out to the grocery store, they run about $15 to $17 when they have their two-for-one sales.
Yeah, they're very expensive, I know, yeah.
This is the powdered rather than the liquid, yeah.
And there's about 20% left, 15 to 20%?
About 20% left, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Dell'Osto. Mr. Campbell? Mm-hmm.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Scott Campbell. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represent the United States in this appeal. I'd like to address first the question of mootness, then turn to the issue of whether this Court has appellate jurisdiction, and then, if interest and time permit, address the question, the legal question as to whether the district court applied the burden of proof or imposed the burden of proof
correctly. That's not an interesting question, actually.
Okay, that's fine. I'll skip it. And should it be interesting, then, perhaps, in the alternative?
What is interesting is whether the government produced enough evidence. That's interesting. Whether they should have tested the 300 to 500 cans, as Mr. Dell'Osto suggested.
And I'd be honored to discuss those, Your Honor. I'd be honored to discuss those issues. I'd like to first address, though, a question that Judge Sykes raised that goes to the issue as to of whether this Court still has appellate jurisdiction. Is this case moot, or is there really a live justiciable issue here? And I submit that as a practical matter, it's almost moot to moot, and here's why. I would part ways slightly with Mr. Dell'Osto's estimate. Mr. Dell'Osto's partner, April 14th of last year, during the first evidentiary hearing on this issue, advised Judge Edelman that, quote, if we put this off another year, there would be nothing. There would be no value to any of the stuff, if that's the court's question. And that's at page 7-8.
It's not moot if there's at least one can that hasn't expired yet, right?
Well, Your Honor, as a practical matter, I'd like to go to
As a practical matter, I don't think mootness is a... If they want to litigate over one can, I don't know what the point would be, but if that's what they want to do, that's their right. Right?
It's still not a minimum amount
of controversy requirement.
Your Honor, it's not moot today, I guess, my point. But by the time a decision comes out, if the court were to remand this, and then ultimately a Marshall sale were ordered, as a practical matter, this stuff would be either all expired or what remains would be so short dated that would have no real market value.
That's very conjectural. We might act fast. We've done that.
What's the latest expiration date? That'll get to the heart of the question of mootness very quickly.
Your Honor, there is some later in 09. Later in 09.
Well, we're in 09, so later in 09 doesn't tell us anything. How much later?
I think there's some in the summer of 09. I want to say July of 09, somewhere in there. But in terms of market value of this, there is this concept of...
Okay, that's a really bad argument. What's your next argument? I don't understand your appellate jurisdiction argument. Yeah, forget the mootness. I mean, obviously, this is irreparable harm to them. Why shouldn't they be allowed to appeal?
Well, as I understand the court's decision in Barnes v. Black, which I know Your Honor participated in the panel on that, basically the notion is that under the collateral order doctrine, one may seek an immediate appeal of a non-final order only if deferring the appeal of that issue would cause irreparable harm. And the question squarely put before...
arguing that, you know, if they can't sell this stuff, they lose its value, which is obviously they do. But that's certainly irreparable harm.
But I think the question, Your Honor, is whether deferring the issue
is
they have raised...
Is that irreparable harm or not irreparable harm?
if the stuff became valuable on our watch, that looked at alone would be irreparable harm. I grant that.
Why shouldn't we look at it alone? I don't understand you.
Well, the issue that's been raised before the court and was raised before the district court is what is the burden of proof. That was the issue that was raised below and the issue that's presented to you. So when you look at that question alone, the only one that's been squarely presented, that issue is irrelevant. It is not too important to be denied review today because it doesn't matter.
Now, their whole argument is that if the burden of proof had been properly assigned, they would have been allowed to sell their stuff.
Well,
If they're right, of course they've suffered irreparable harm.
Well, I think, Your Honor, what's happening is that they're trying to squeeze...
The real loser of an argument. What? This is one of the clearest cases of irreparable harm that a court could confront, where your valuable baby formula is going to become unsaleable. You're going to lose, maybe $100,000 or what have you, unless you get an immediate appeal, the reversal that might result in in this interlocutory sale before the last can has expired.
But Your Honor, I respect that and I agree with that decision. But the question that's been presented to the court is...
That's a terrible argument. Now, what about this question of evidence? Did the judge have enough evidence to say this stuff is unsafe, or maybe unsafe, and I'm not going to allow it to be sold?
Yes, we presented ample evidence.
You discussed that in your brief.
Excuse me, Your Honor?
You didn't discuss the evidence. You didn't make an argument about it, but you can make it now.
Your Honor, I'll gladly do it, but I'd like to point out that...
No, I asked you a question. Answer my question.
I shall, Your Honor. My answer is this. We presented ample evidence. We called the Director of Food Safety from Mead Johnson. We called the Director of Food Safety from Abbott Laboratories. We called the number one regulator at the FDA, Dr. Benson Silverman, and we asked him squarely, is this formula too risky to sell? And two of those three witnesses answered squarely, yes, it's too risky to sell. Dr. Silverman from the FDA informed the district court, advised the district court, that if the FDA had jurisdiction over this product coming out of a relabeling warehouse, it would not allow it to be sold. But regrettably, the FDA lacks jurisdiction over this non-manufacturing operation. We had ample evidence, Judge, to say this formula is unsafe, and I'll describe it in brief. First off, these cans were cleaned with solvents, xylene, toluene. Additionally, the Kalades warehouse operation, workers there used, X-Acto knives and things to clean the cans. And some of these cans are composite cans, not metal cans. They could be pierced. But the most significant risk posed, and I know that Your Honor, probably of all people in the room, appreciates the notion of harm being sort of a product of probability of harm times the outcome of that result, albeit perhaps in this case unlikely. But all three witnesses, whom I described before, advised the court that the greatest risk that they saw was the risk of mislabeling. We know that the Kalades had an extensive relabeling operation. We don't know which cans were relabeled. And that's why, in answering the court's question before about sample testing, whether that would have been adequate, that would have been inadequate for the simple reason that we're not dealing with a mechanized, standardized labeling process here as you have at the manufacturing level. To the contrary, you had a helter-skelter, ad hoc relabeling of certain cans where apparently someone, either the Kalades or the people who sold the cans to them, had tried to remove a marking from the label, had tried to remove a sticker, had torn the label. So they harvested labels from expired cans and put them onto another can. That created the risk of mislabeling, particularly because at the Kalades Enterprise warehouse, you could see in various exhibits that are discussed in the transcripts, there are photos of mixed cans altogether. You had milk-based formula, soy-based formula, and other hypoallergenic formulas mixed together. Additionally, that was on the front end, the stuff that was to be cleaned. Additionally, you had stacks of labels of different types of formula that were mixed together as well, something you'd never see at the manufacturing level, as our expert witnesses pointed out. As a result, that posed the grave risk of mislabeling, and indeed, true mislabeling, because we had one can, one box that one of the FBI agents found that had gone through the relabeling process that contained a mislabeled can. Now, in that case, the mislabeling would not have caused a harm. It was Isomil Advanced that was in an Isomil plain label. But the ingredients were different. It was mislabeling according to the FDA. Now, what matters, Your Honor, as I'm sure the court appreciates from the facts we did discuss in this issue in the brief, there is a grave danger that if a child with a milk allergy consumes a milk-based formula, that could put that infant into anaphylactic shock, which could result in death. So the question is there any risk, or is there a risk we should care about, that some milk-based formula is in fact cloaked in a hypoallergenic label? That's a real danger. And we can't rule that out. The only way to rule that out would be to examine every single can and to compare the code on the bottom of the can, where it exists, and they generally do, with the label on the can. But its expert Dan March testified at the end of his testimony on April 14th, when you're looking at 80,000 cans, your eyes can get lazy. You can just miss one. So there's a real danger in having a human reviewer look at what is ordinarily a mechanized process at the manufacturing level. As the manufacturers testified, they never mix cans and labels. So when you have human intervention to try to see if you missed a can, one could still be missed, and one child could get very sick or die. And
Mr. Campbell, what about this legal argument, subsidiary legal argument that's being made about because this is a de facto ultimate forfeiture, that the government should have the burden of proving its forfeiture case on the merits in the context of a motion for an interlocutory
Three trial. Arguments. One, that was waived. They didn't raise it before Judge Edelman. Two, it makes no sense. It would undercut the whole purpose of having an interlocutory order. Three, there is a provision for asking for a merits decision, and neither party asked for one at this point. So if that's what they want, they could have asked for one, and they didn't. So it's waived on that level as well.
There's a provision in the G7 scheme or in the statutory scheme?
I think it's in the statutory scheme. I think it's 18 U.S.C. 983. Now, to be sure, though, either party could ask for a stay, but because no one asked for a merits hearing here, that issue was not presented to the district court.
And I take it there is no damages remedy against the government for an improper forfeiture if you were to lose on the merits?
It's an open question. This circuit, the Ninth Circuit, addressed this recently in a 2008 decision. It's United States v. Foster. And basically, CAFRA, and my time is up, but I'd love to answer the question if I may. CAFRA has a limited waiver of the government's sovereign immunity for items that are damaged when they are seized for the purpose of forfeiture. And the question that this case would pose, frankly, is whether in this case, where the formula was seized initially pursuant to a search warrant and only months later pursuant to a seizure warrant, would that limited waiver of sovereign immunity apply? Foster was presented with the same facts, and under those facts, the Ninth Circuit held that the government had not waived sovereign immunity, that it remained immune. So I would argue, Your Honor, if that question were presented to this court or the district court, that we are immune from damages. But this court has not squarely addressed that question.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Campbell. Mr. Dell'Osto, how much time does he have? No time? Well, we'll give you a minute anyway.
I know the court's backed up a bit, so I'll be brief. Just in response to the court's questioning of Mr. Campbell, we did not waive, I disagree with him respectfully, he's a good advocate, the issue on the burden of proof, asking for a stay before Judge Edelman. He's already denied us the interlocutory appeal. As far as I direct the court to look at our initial brief at page 10 and also our reply brief at page 3, which talks about the facts that the Mead-Johnson representative, this is Dan March, and Judge Posner, when you and I were talking earlier about representative testing, Judge Edelman asked, could you test 40 or 50 cans internally to see if they were tainted? He said, well, Mr. March said 400 to 500 we'd have to be tested, but we could then get a valid testing. We presented Dr. Weiss, and that's at page 10 for the sites under the record, who did test the cans. And these are composite cans, which are both paper, cardboard, plastic, aluminum, are both waterproof and largely solvent-proof for light, everyday kitchen solvents like Goof Off or whatever, and found that there was not, when heat was applied or the solvents, any kind of leaking through. There was no penetration. So the only positive proof of the problem of are the cans tainted was presented by Colodi, and that showed there wasn't. And there was conjecture, there was speculation, but not one test of one can by the government. And again, we're dealing in these days, and I know the court may think, well, we've got the thing down in Georgia with the peanut butter. We have the melamine in China. This is not that case. This would be more like suddenly saying we're going to take all of this on a conjecture that there's a problem with the food product, but we're not going to test it. And we saw what that did with the tomato crop last year out in the West Coast. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much to both counsel.